year with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. COVID vaccine distribution is racing ahead as our state hit a grim milestone last week, surpassing 6,000 deaths. DHS, Department of Health Services, accounting here, more than 761,000 vaccines have been administered in our state as of Saturday. According to the Wisconsin Hospital Association dashboard, there are 570 COVID patients hospitalized as of yesterday, that number trending downward. If you're fighting COVID or helping a loved one through it, what questions do you have? Have you been vaccinated? Did you experience side effects? How long did they last? It's 800-642-1234. Allison Schwartz is Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health's Wisconsin region. She treats patients in Madison and Janesville. Dr. Schwartz, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
You received both doses of the Pfizer vaccine now. What was that experience like for you?
It was very exciting. I think there was a lot of anticipation, you know, going back, you know, essentially a year this has been in the making. So I got my first dose of the vaccine in December, and it was very well tolerated, nothing really worrisome. My arm was a little sore for about a day. And then 3 weeks later, I came back for my second vaccine I had in early January. I did experience some of the side effects people are talking about, just a little bit of fatigue, achiness, very short-lived. Totally worth it, because I knew that it meant I was protecting myself. My immune system was ramping up and, you know, preparing antibodies to fight SARS-CoV-2 if I were exposed to the virus in the future.
And that fatigue and a little bit of fogginess, that, as you said, it didn't last long.
No, I thought it was really, you know, I kind of went in with the expectation that may happen. If it does happen, it was kind of a good reminder to me that my immune system was waking up, doing what it was supposed to do to develop all these antibodies and everything. But it was nothing that lasted. I think my symptoms, I was telling my friends, it was like, you know, 1 minute they were there, the next minute they were gone. And so it all in all lasted about 28 hours. And then I just felt, you know, as if nothing had happened. And I was able to function and still work and everything, just felt a little bit under the weather, but nothing unexpected. And again, to me, it was a good reminder that the vaccine was doing what it was supposed to do. And I did just fine with it.
So what is the status of your fellow healthcare workers with SSM Health and receiving the vaccine?
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting things going on with the vaccine and the vaccine efforts. You know, it's all kind of supply dependent based on the state, but SSM Health last week and the week before, we vaccinated about 11,000 people each week. So you can see the numbers. These include both healthcare workers and then some of the eligible groups within the community. When we rolled out the vaccines initially to employees, they had sent a survey, you know, asking who would be interested, and about 2/3 of people said they would be interested. But as of this week, we've actually vaccinated about 90% of our eligible employees. So really exciting stuff happening.
So do workers have a choice whether they wish to get the COVID vaccine or not?
It is. It's completely up to the worker whether or not they want to pursue vaccination. This is not mandatory. There's a lot of decision making that goes into that. And because this is not FDA authorized, it's an emergency use authorization. So that is sort of an important distinction when we talk about mandating vaccines. And so SSM made the decision to make this a choice, but trying to provide our employees with some decision making tools and education about the vaccine so they felt informed and empowered to make that decision. And it is exciting to see that, you know, over 90% of people then have decided to move forward with it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with infectious disease specialist Allison Schwartz of SSM Health, fielding your questions about the COVID vaccination, the distribution. She's clearing up misconceptions that we'll be talking about circulating about the vaccine. Have you been vaccinated? What was that like for you? What was it like to get an appointment? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Schwartz, SSM Health has 17 vaccination sites currently operating. Can you tell us the status of those sites in terms of who is able to get vaccinated and how many people are being vaccinated?
Sure. Right now, I mean, all of the decisions about vaccination are being guided by the advisory panels and these phases of eligible patients based on what our Department of Health and then the CDC has recommended. And so right now, the largest group of patients who are eligible are those age 65 and older. Obviously, group 1A was the healthcare workers, any other, patient-facing employees, so, dental workers, we have EMS, other first responders. With the 1B group now, we're vaccinating firefighters and policemen. There's certain educators that are eligible, but really trying to stick to the guidelines. And part of the vaccination effort for SSM Health was to not only, center things in Madison, but to reach some of the surrounding communities. And so as you brought up that we have actually, I think, 18 now state-approved vaccinations sites that are up and running so that there's, good access for people. Again, most of the delays have been because of supply. And I think, that's something we don't have a lot of control over, but is, hopefully slowly improving over the course of time. But then by bringing these vaccination sites to some of the surrounding communities that we service has enabled a lot more people to get safely somewhere to be vaccinated and not have to travel far from home to do so.
How do the vaccine clinics cut down on or prevent doses from being wasted?
Right. And so we're proactively reaching out to all eligible patients who are eligible to schedule and then basically, preparing the doses based on that. And so I know there are certain days where there may be vaccines left over, and they have a call list of people who are eligible to then come in so that no doses are wasted because it is such a precious resource right now.
Oh, so you have like a kind of a standby list in case someone doesn't make their appointment?
Correct, exactly.
And is this reaching out to patients who are in your system? Is that who these doses are going to?
Right. So we have, for the most part right now, prioritized SSM Health patients. However, it is important that even those patients who do not have a doctor within our system could still be eligible for vaccination. And especially some of those, non-affiliated, like dental workers or other healthcare workers, they certainly would be eligible for vaccination through SSM Health. They do not need to be a patient. And so there's a lot more information about this on the website. So I would encourage people to visit SSMHealth.com. There's a form there that someone can fill out as an interest form, and that will put you on the list. It's not a waiting list, but it's an interest form so that as we work through these groups, we know who may still be eligible but otherwise unvaccinated. Another great resource is the Department of Health. And so, through the Wisconsin Department of Health, there's links on there depending on what health system you are affiliated with, whether it's, SSM or UW, Meritor, somewhere else surrounding. And then there's also a link about information for eligible groups who may not be affiliated with a health system.
Do you feel that SSM Health has enough vaccinators, has enough, health workers to stand up all of these sites?
Right now, yes. There's been a really coordinated effort within the health system to make sure that was not an issue. And so the clinics seem to be running very smoothly. We do have enough workers and obviously enough interested patients. And so it's exciting to see all the hard work of the committee who's been working on this, for several months, having it come together and run so smoothly.
Allison Schwartz is an infectious disease specialist with SSM Health Dean Medical Group. She's explaining the benefits of getting vaccinated, the health risks associated with COVID, and how to help stop the spread this hour. Have you learned something about the vaccine on social media or from loved ones that you want clarity on from a doctor? Are you wondering about what it's like to treat COVID patients in the hospital and what to expect? What do you want to know about long haulers? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Schwartz here on the Ideas Network. We're getting your questions answered about COVID vaccines here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease specialist, on Fresh Air last week answering the question that is on all of our minds.
In our own country, if we get the overwhelming majority of people, I would say 70 to 85% of the people vaccinated, that we could get this down to the point where the level of infection is so low that it is not a threat of any consequences to most people.
Will you be vaccinated? What concerns you about the vaccine? What do you want to know about COVID interventions? 800-642-1234. Dr. Allison Schwartz is an infectious disease specialist, and she stays with us. Let's bring in Rich now in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi. I was vaccinated last week, and I'm grateful. I found it very easy to get the vaccine because of my age and my medical conditions. But my comment or question to the doctor is, it's incredibly easy for someone my age and in my socioeconomic status to isolate and protect myself. I'm really worried that the people who have the most public contact and are most exposed are getting this vaccine slower. I'll leave it at that and let the doctor comment.
Rich, thank you for that. Dr. Schwartz, you know, what is the exposure of frontline healthcare workers, and when might they be able to be vaccinated?
Right. I think Rich is correct in that so much of this pandemic has, you know, highlighted a lot of healthcare disparities and access to medical care. And now we talk about access to vaccination. And so as we see the supplies of vaccine increase over the next, you know, couple weeks to several months, it is really important that there's a concerted effort from a public health standpoint to reach those vulnerable communities and the other frontline workers. And so right now, again, we're still in that 1B phase, and we've already worked through 1A. And so you talk about healthcare workers and other patient-facing employees, for example, but within the next phase of 1C, which we hope to be rolling out in the next several weeks, will include a lot of those other frontline workers who are not directly in healthcare, but patients such as, you know, grocery store workers, other childcare workers, patients who may not have had an option but to continue working throughout this pandemic, and they themselves are vulnerable just because of the line of work that they do.
Let's go to Jane now in Suamico. Jane, what is your situation?
I have my 90-year-old mother lives with me. We've both been vaccinated, and her 88-year-old sister is being vaccinated. Once we've let a couple weeks pass after the second vaccination, can we go and visit and sit together and have a meal and hug each other?
This is a great question, and I'm glad you brought it up, because there's a lot of talk going around about once you get vaccinated, you know, still practicing so many of the guidelines we've recommended, such as masking and social distancing and hand washing. But the scenario what you talk about are three people then who are all vaccinated coming together, you know, at your home to share time together and be together. And that, to me, is going to be very safe. And so I'm still cautioning people, once they're vaccinated, that's not a free pass to, you know, just go crazy and be out at the bars every weekend and some of the things we've been kind of discouraging the public to do up until this point. But in a scenario where you are all protected, the risk of spreading infection to one another is very low. And that's something we're still waiting to learn about the vaccine, is getting the vaccine, does it protect you from, if you were to become infected, from spreading to others? But again, in this scenario, when all three of you have been vaccinated and should have some level of immunity, I do think that's safe. And I think for your mental health, that sounds like something that's really going to be worth looking forward to.
With the three of them vaccinated, would you suggest they still wear masks?
You know, I think that if you're not eating or drinking, then still masking and just trying to be careful is the general guidance. But I think that the risk is going to be much lower in that group. The other thing they do have to keep in mind, though, is if there's other people in your household who are not vaccinated, again, this idea that if you were to become exposed and then bring something home to an unvaccinated loved one, we still have to be careful about that. But if it's just, you know, you, your mom, and then your mom's sister, and there's no other unvaccinated people involved, then I do think that's relatively safe. And wearing the mask just as an extra layer precaution, you know, could still be recommended, but there are certain scenarios where I think it would be safe for the three of you to take the mask off and be together.
We have Dr. Ellison Schwartz of SSM Health. She's part of the infectious disease team. She's fielding your questions about the COVID vaccine and the latest on how physicians are battling this disease and the public health protocols. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Jennifer is with us from Oconomowoc. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for your guest. I think it was very timely to have your guest follow Representative Kapenga, because my question sort of to you follows. The Republican legislator described their method for determining the efficacy of public mask wearing, and that was to look retrospectively at the correlation between spikes in cases and when a mask mandate was in place. And I'm just curious what your guest thinks about using this retrospective correlational approach to making decisions about whether mask wearing is effective.
Jennifer, thank you. Dr. Schwartz, is there a correlation?
Sure. I mean, there have been several studies that have shown that the mask wearing not only does protect the wearer, but also those around them. And I think there's a lot of, you know, sort of drawbacks to this retrospective analysis with some of the peaks and not necessarily a great evaluation of what was the compliance with the masking at that time. And so I think it's challenging to make those conclusions where we have, you know, a lot of other, you know, well-designed controlled trials that do show the benefit of masking. It's also important to recognize with masking, a lot of the effects may lag several weeks. And so when you're looking at rates of infection and hospitalization, sometimes it does lag a little bit. So there's not necessarily always a clear correlation between, you know, when a mask mandate came into effect and what the downstream effect on the actual infection rates and hospitalization rates were. So I think it does get a little bit muddy when you look at things that way.
Let's bring in Gary now in Brookfield. Gary, you have been vaccinated as well.
No, I have not.
Oh, you have not. I'm sorry.
I get vaccinated in a couple of days. But I had two questions that I wanted to ask the doctor. Number one was, given that this is a virus and they have confirmed that it's mutating, similar to the way the influenza virus mutates, after you've been vaccinated a second time, I presume you're going to have some sort of vaccination to maintain this, what would you call it, resistance to the virus in the future. And so the first question is, how long do you think that period of time will be before there will be like a second vaccine? And the second question I had is, I read a piece over the weekend that over in Israel, they had just developed a drug, an experimental drug that was a therapeutic for people who have COVID, and it had proved 100% effective in preventing people from dying from COVID.
Hmm. All right.
If she'd heard anything about that.
Gary, thank you. The first question there on the mutating virus and how long immunity would last with this vaccine.
Right. And so we're still learning exactly how long the durable immunity from the vaccine will last. And so just like many other vaccines, you know, sometimes you do need boosters several years later. So, you know, for example, after people, certain young people get a pneumonia vaccine, then, you know, 5 years later, they'll need a booster. Many more people are familiar with a tetanus shot, for example. So I do think that at some point, we probably will need boosters for this vaccine. However, that's yet to be determined. Now, specifically regarding the variants or these mutations, as Gary mentioned, we are, you know, the science community is closely watching these and then looking very closely at the vaccines that we have and making sure that the virus has not changed enough where our vaccines aren't going to work, because that obviously would be a big concern as we roll out all of our vaccination efforts if the vaccine or if the virus is mutating so much that the vaccines will not work, then we're sort of starting over. And so right now it is encouraging to say that regarding the that UK variant or the B117 that everyone talks about, initial data does show that the Pfizer vaccine and presumably the Moderna vaccine are still effective against this variant. And so our goal essentially is to make sure we continue to roll out vaccination efforts to get that number of circulating virus essentially down to nothing, because it's the circulating virus that will continue to escape our immunity and then mutate more. They're still looking at, there's some other what we call variants of concern, and so there's particularly one in South Africa and one in Brazil, for example. There will be others that pop up, and we don't have as much information about how well the vaccines are going to work for those variants, and maybe some of the initial data from some of the other vaccine candidates shows that the vaccines may not be as effective in preventing illness, but still very effective in preventing severe disease or death. And so that, to me, is still, you know, very important when we look at outcomes with vaccination.
And we're going to get to the other piece of that, of Gary's question on therapeutics and what has evolved there for treating COVID patients. We have Allison Schwartz, Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health's Wisconsin region. We're getting the latest on the COVID vaccine rollout, how physicians are treating cases. Healthcare clinicians, what is your patient load like for COVID cases? What is the most frequent question you get about COVID and the vaccine? What do you say? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Dr. Schwartz after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the COVID vaccine, fielding all your questions on the rollout, the misconceptions, who is next in line to get it. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor, said on Fresh Air last week that we must do whatever we can to prevent the replication of the virus.
By vaccinating as many people as quickly and as efficiently as you possibly can, and also to double down on the public health measures of uniform wearing of masks, physical distancing, avoiding congregate settings, particularly indoors.
Do you wonder about the different vaccines from the drug makers and levels of efficacy? Do you wonder about what the COVID booster shot does? What have you heard about side effects and you want clarity on? 800-642-1234. SSM Health Infectious Disease Specialist Allison Schwartz is with us for the hour. Dr. Schwartz, Gary had wanted to know as well about the new successful therapeutic drugs that are on the horizon or are being used right now to treat hospitalized COVID patients.
Right. There's still a lot of research going on, really looking at various therapeutics, because I think even with vaccination, we're still going to continue to see some people getting sick. And obviously, while people are waiting for vaccination, still trying to optimize the care that we're giving these patients. And so it sounds like in Israel, they're looking at some new what are called immune modulating therapies. And so part of the late stage of a COVID infection is that you get this really overreaction of your immune system, where we get what's called the cytokine storm, and really just the immune system kind of fighting the virus out of proportion for what's needed. And that's what's causing critical illness in a lot of patients. And so here in the U.S., there's some studies going on looking at various immune therapies. And then over in Israel, it looked like something similar, but still just in the early stages with small numbers, and certainly exciting, but we don't want to draw too many conclusions until more of the, you know, advanced trials are done and we can really draw some strong conclusions on it.
Dr. Schwartz, have you seen medical intervention change much in recent weeks, in recent months, with COVID, hospitalized COVID patients, especially in intensive care?
You know, I think in the beginning, things were very, very different. So going back to, you know, March and April and moving into the summer a little bit, we were at the very early stages of trying to understand this virus and the why, you know, patients would get so sick, and now understanding kind of phases of the illness. The viral
and there was the urge, you know, the urge for ventilators, getting more ventilators.
Exactly. Yeah, so we've learned quite a bit since then, and things have changed. You know, I think one important piece of that would be, for example, the hydroxychloroquine story, where initially it was felt to be very beneficial, and then we realized we could actually be doing more harm. And so that's kind of the evolution of science as things have changed. And I think that what we're doing now has sort of stabilized off using some of the drugs, like people have probably heard of remdesivir, that's an antiviral drug, really steroids being one of the most important interventions that we've been able to use for patients because of this inflammation that we talked about. And then other just supportive care measures, as you talked about ventilation, but then different ventilation strategies. People may have heard of, you know, actually keeping patients on their belly so that oxygen can get to different parts of the lung, et cetera. So we've learned quite a bit, and it's really been a collaboration between, you know, the various subspecialties involved, us as infectious disease doctors, the pulmonary doctors, our ICU colleagues, the hospital doctors, everyone kind of working together to come up with these treatments and figuring out what works for patients.
Where does the medical community stand on convalescent plasma now?
Yeah, so I think we were all really excited about convalescent plasma early on, and the studies just did not really play out that that was going to be of great benefit for most patients. And I think what we're learning is that the benefit of convalescent plasma would be very, very early in someone's illness, probably even earlier than when they may themselves may recognize that they're sick, because by the time that they come in, if you've started to develop your own antibodies against the virus, then the convalescent plasma is not going to help. And so there has been some data show that in very small subset of patients who maybe have some sort of immune deficiency or on medications that prevent their immune system from making antibodies, maybe convalescent plasma would be helpful in that situation. But that's another example where, you know, it was a therapeutic we were really excited about in the beginning. And then unfortunately, once we got more larger scale clinical trials, it just didn't prove to be as helpful as we would have hoped.
Let's bring in Sarah now, who's joining us from Madison with a question. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about once you get vaccinated, and how does that affect the chances of you infecting someone else? And is there, you know, what's the research on that? And I've heard, you know, stories about, oh, it decreases your viral load enough that, you know, but I don't know if that's true, and I would just like to know the answer to that.
Sure. So the for the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, which are the two that we have authorized in the United States right now, they actually didn't look at this in the trials. And part of that, you know, in hindsight, we're like, oh, I wish we would have done more surveillance to see if people are asymptomatically infected and could therefore, you know, give virus to other people. But we also have to understand that at the time the trials were being done, we were just trying to, you know, get as much data as we could as quickly as possible to get these vaccines approved. And so, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and they're working on, you know, looking at that now, doing sampling of patients who may not be having symptoms just to see if they have virus and could be giving it to others. So we don't actually know for sure. I think there is this theoretical idea that because you're preventing viral replication by being vaccinated, that if you do have virus that, you know, gets into your nasopharynx or your airway, that it's not going to replicate enough that you're shedding a meaningful amount to infect other people, but we just don't know yet. And I brought up those two vaccines because some of the other trials and overseas looking at the AstraZeneca vaccine, for example, they did start to look at this, and it does appear that, you know, that vaccine, which it works a little bit differently, but did reduce the viral shedding in those patients. But we're just not quite there yet to say, once you get your vaccine, take off your mask, it's no concern. We really want to take that altruistic view of, you know, you may still have the potential to have some virus and therefore need to protect those around you. And that's why the masking continues to be important, just until we know a little bit more or enough people in the community are vaccinated that we reach some, you know, some semblance of herd immunity, and then it's not as much of a concern.
Let's bring in Sylvia, who is joining us from New Richmond. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, Kate. How are you this morning?
Doing well. What's your question?
No question. I just wanted to let everybody know I'm 83. I live in senior housing here in New Richmond, Wisconsin, about 60 miles east of the Twin Cities. And I have had no effects whatever, no problems. The arm got a little sore, but that's all. So I just want to reassure some of the older folks not to worry, at least not for me. I'm sorry, but I just wanted to let the public know it was fine.
Sylvia, where did you get your dose, may I ask?
Here in New Richmond in senior housing.
Oh, so you didn't even have to leave home.
No, it was wonderful.
Oh.
It went perfect. It just was wonderful.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. Yeah, Dr. Schwartz, it sounds like, you know, for seniors, some seniors, they're able to get it right where they live.
Yeah, I think that's such an exciting story that Sylvia had that, it, you know, it sounds like it was relatively seamless and easy. And I think Wisconsin's actually doing, you know, relatively well from that standpoint compared to some other states. So it's good to hear. We don't want this to be challenging to people. And in a setting like a senior living situation where there may be other people around and certainly vulnerable populations, it's a great story that they actually brought the vaccine to you. And so you didn't have to worry about traveling in the winter and everything.
We're talking with Dr. Allison Schwartz, Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health. We're looking at the latest on the COVID vaccine and how doctors are battling the virus in patients. Taking your questions about the vaccine, 800-642-1234. Nathaniel is joining us from Campbellsport. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi there. I'm starting to hear more from family members of mine that are strongly pro-life, that there's some kind of relationship between abortion and this vaccine. And I wonder if there's some kind of grain of truth somewhere in that and maybe how to talk to them about it. Like, I thought, if anything, they might just sort of be confusing that, you know, in a lot of genetic research, there might be fetal stem cells or something like that. But I have got some family members that at least they're like choosing at least one of the brands of them that they won't get because of its relationship with abortion. And I was just wondering where's the truth lie and how to talk to them about this.
Yeah, Nathaniel, thank you. Dr. Schwartz.
Thanks, Nathaniel. That's really interesting. I actually have not heard that yet. I know that there were some questions early on about fertility and vaccination, and if you get vaccinated, would it affect your fertility long term? There was sort of a theory about some relationship between some cell-mediated immunity and some downstream effects for fertility. And all of this has been, you know, scientifically disproven that there really is no relationship. And in regards to the specific question about abortion, that, as I mentioned, I am unfamiliar with. It's certainly something that for your family members, I would be very interested in seeing sort of a good source of that, because I think we'd be talking about it more if it truly were a correlation.
You know, Johnson & Johnson announced last week it had applied with the FDA to obtain its emergency use for its COVID vaccine, but there have been concerns that the company's vaccine is not as effective as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. How do you negotiate that line between get more vaccines on the market and get more people vaccinated versus the efficacy of the vaccine?
Sure. I mean, the Johnson & Johnson, although looking at prevention of illness, the efficacy looked lower. If you look at prevention of severe disease, hospitalization, death, they were actually very effective, upwards of 85%. And there are lots of benefits to this vaccination in that they don't have, there's not all of the cold chain storage concerns that come up with the Pfizer Moderna product. It's actually just one vaccine rather than two. So you don't have to worry about bringing people back for a second vaccination, for example. And so I think that although, you know, looking at the numbers, it's really important to tease out the data. And when we talk about kind of wide-scale distribution, again, trying to get as many people vaccinated as much as we can to stop viral replication and stop the spread of the virus is going to be our key priority right now. And even if it's slightly less effective, but it does prevent hospitalization and death, I think that's the best news ever. And because supply has been such an issue, if this can help increase our supply in the United States to get more people vaccinated, then I think it's going to be a really great addition to the vaccines that we already have. And it's also important to recognize that as the studies go on, maybe there will be a front runner and we do booster vaccine with other vaccinations or what have you, but something we'll continue to look at.
We're talking with infectious disease specialist Allison Schwartz. She's here answering your questions about COVID, about interventions, what the vaccine will do in fighting this crisis. Have you received your dose? What do you want to know about immunity? What do you want to know about mask wearing? How do you feel when it will be your turn to get the vaccination. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with infectious disease physician Allison Schwartz. She's fielding all your questions about COVID vaccines, caring for COVID patients, and what can be done to help limit the spread. More than 761,000 vaccines have been administered in our state as of Saturday. And according to the Wisconsin Hospital Association, there are 570 COVID patients hospitalized as of yesterday. Let's go to Joy now in West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to go over this one more time about the masks. The legislator that was on said that there was no correlation between mask mandate and the number of cases going down. And then there was this guest said that the mask mandate does help, but I want to clarify that and ask about other things. In other countries, they've had more success. There wasn't data from our state about how many people actually wear masks. Mm-hmm. In my area, there are so many people who resist wearing masks that I don't think they can make any true conclusions about how the mask mandate works.
And Joy, I want Dr. Schwartz to be able to say exactly, you know, what do masks do and why are they so vital in this crisis, in this pandemic?
Yeah, so the way that masks work is that we know this virus spreads through respiratory droplets. And so every time, you know, we're talking, singing, even breathing, sometimes these respiratory droplets are expelled into the air and then could potentially infect those others around you. And so the benefit of masking not only is felt to be, you know, protecting those around you by wearing the mask to kind of keep those respiratory droplets contained, but also then by you masking kind of gives that extra layer of protection to protect you from breathing in droplets from other people around you who may not be masking. And so, you know, truly, I agree with Joy in that I think a lot of, you know, when you look at case rates and the mask mandates, it's not like a well-controlled study to exactly tie together whether or not someone who was infected was wearing a mask or not to draw those broad conclusions. But as I mentioned, there have been now several studies that have looked at masking and how it does control the spread of the virus in a controlled setting, looking in like a trial setting, and it is felt to be beneficial. And so, you know, within Dane County in particular, we, along with the other healthcare systems, continue to recommend masking and have continued to make it mandatory within our health settings as an important way to help spread the curve of infection.
What about double masking? The CDC has not issued guidance about wearing two masks, and we're seeing that happen. What are your thoughts?
Right. The idea of double masking came about, again, as we talk about these variants, because part of the problem with the variants that we are seeing spreading, and now in the United States, we know that the B117, that UK variant, is spreading very readily within the United States. And part of the problem is that they're felt to be more infective, and so maybe spreading more readily, or once you're exposed, have a greater potential to actually infect you. So people started wearing double masks. And the important thing about double masking is you need to make sure that if you are double masking, that it's comfortable, that you can, you know, you still feel you're able to breathe, and that if it's too tight, you're double masking too tight, you may be forcing, you know, air or droplets outside of the mask. So I think it's something that's worth considering, but we haven't been able to draw clear conclusions as to whether or not it's going to be more than one, just because, again, you want to make sure people are doing it correctly. And from my standpoint, I know there's been so much resistance to mask wearing in general. I think, you know, by mandating people wear two masks or something, we don't want to make it more complicated for people. I think we'll learn more about the double masking, and in certain situations it may be beneficial, but really, at least just, you know, one mask is going to, you know, be much better than none, for example.
Let's go to Christina now in Glenwood. Hi, Christina. What is your question?
Hi there. Thank you. I'm wondering, are people with underlying medical conditions at greater risk for reaction to the vaccine? And how is this managed if someone does have a reaction?
Sure. So all of the vaccine sites need to be approved by the state. And for the reason for that is in the rare risk that people are having an anaphylactic reaction, which, is 1 out of 10 million, it seems to be where we're at right now, that the vaccine site is then appropriately set up to handle that. So whether it be an EpiPen or Benadryl, obviously healthcare providers on hand to handle those reactions. And again, it's very, very rare. Nobody who's had a vaccine reaction has died from it. So that's important to know that although there have been these handful of reports of people having anaphylaxis, and of course that gets into the news, all of those patients have done well. And sort of the takeaway would be you're more likely to die of, you know, a car crash on your way to get the vaccine than you are from the vaccine itself. Okay. In regards to the other question about being immune compromised, we actually feel that the vaccine is very safe for people who are immune compromised, and because your risk from severe disease with COVID-19 is actually more than someone of the general population, we would encourage people who are immune compromised to get vaccinated. Now, it may be that these are not live vaccines, so you can't get sick from the vaccine. You can't get SARS-CoV-2 from the vaccine, and that's a reason where some people who are immune compromised may not be able to get other vaccines. For example, the chickenpox vaccine is a live vaccine, you wouldn't be able to get that. So this is not that kind of situation. And by getting the current vaccines that we have may, in fact, protect you from the severe illness, which you may be at risk, more risk for than other, you know, members of the population. When they've started to look at the studies, it seems that people who are immune compromised may not mount as much of an immune response, just because if you're on certain medications that prevent your immune system from building up these antibodies, for example, then you may not have as much of immune response, but it'll still be much better protection than not having the vaccine itself. So,
Dr. Schwartz, I want to move quickly here to children. Pfizer recently announced it has more than 2,000 kids who are 12 to 15 in a vaccine trial. How long does a trial like this take where we would ultimately get to a vaccine for children?
Yeah, so right now Pfizer has, I think they're completed enrollment for, again, looking at kids 12 to 15, and as you mentioned, over 2,000 kids enrolled in that trial. This is more of a dosing and safety trial, and so making sure we have an appropriate dose and the efficacy. So it's not going to drag out. I imagine that over the course of the next couple months, we'll have more information on this, and then they'll start moving down. I don't think any of the vaccine companies right now have any plans to vaccinate kids younger than 5, but we'll move through the age ranges. And so a lot of people have asked about, you know, is this vaccine going to be mandated for my kids to go back to school next year? I don't think we'll have the data by then. And again, in our youngest children, they're not even planning to study vaccine in those groups. And fortunately, that's, you know, one good thing about this virus is that it doesn't seem to affect children as significantly as it does for adults. And so we need to weigh the risk-benefit of expanding the trials to them and how much it would change the course of the virus, for example.
We only have a few seconds left here, but Dr. Schwartz, are you hopeful as you watch the vaccines roll out that this will be able to ensure that we can one day go back to whatever it is our normal lives would look like?
Sure. I think that we're seeing infection numbers come down, and I want people to feel encouraged by that. But I want everyone to know that these variants are out there, not to scare the public, but, you know, there's still circulating virus. And as we increase our vaccine efforts, we really want to double down on the public health recommendations that we've already made, the masking, the hand washing, the social distancing, so that we can vaccinate as many people as possible, reach that level of herd immunity, kind of don't have to worry about these variants. In that case, I think that there is some hope on the horizon. We're seeing some return to normalcy for many people. And as vaccine ramps up, we'll continue to vaccinate more people and hopefully get there.
Dr. Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much for having me, Kate. I appreciate it.
Allison Schwartz, Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health's Wisconsin Region. And for disclosure, SSM Health is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.